Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions, the podcast of hope. I'm your host, Rory Hernan, joined always by my co-host and alter ego, Tony Groves. Tony, how are you?
I'm very good, Rory. I'm very good. Better than you, but it sounds a bit. I hope that cough is only just a cough, Rory. You know, you don't
Something's getting caught in my throat, but anyway, we'll go for it.
Listen,
I'm surviving.
Just again, we're always at this, guys, but we do need this podcast is listener led, but it's also relies entirely on supporters. You need to head over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. It's the price of a cup of coffee once a month. And you know what? It helps keep the mics on. Rory.
Okay. Yes, Tony, thank you. We're joined this morning. We're delighted to be joined by Michael Burns from the School of Social Policy, Social Work and Social Justice in UCD. Michael has just written a report with Rachel McArdle from the Department of Geography, Maynooth University, called Security and Agency in the Private Rental Sector. Mick, we're delighted to have you with us. Tenants issues have been a major issue in this country that we've looked at over the last couple of years. It's kind of central to the housing crisis, generation rent. What kind of have you found in this report?
Thanks, guys. Delighted to be here. This was a report.
I'm delighted, to have you back. You were actually our first podcast interviewee, and we are now 2 years in. How many episodes later, Tony? Oh, he's gone. We don't know. He's actually given up on how many episodes.
No, I haven't. It's 141. I went in and checked. So go
on. Yeah, and Mick, listen, thanks for being the first. You're back, and thanks for being with us again.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, it is great to be back, and especially to be launching this report, which we did in collaboration with Threshold. And what we wanted to look at is really this issue, which I think is key to everything else that happens in the private rental sector, which is to do with the impact of insecurity on tenants' agency or tenants' ability to advocate for themselves. Now, we know there's been a huge amount of new legislation in the sector going back to 2015. We've had some strengthening of security of tenure. We have, obviously, the RPZ rent caps. But time and again, we see that the policies that are put in place aren't as effective as we'd like them to be, right? And one of the reasons for this is there is a significant problem with non-compliance on the part of landlords, right? Landlords just don't always follow the legislation. And this brings up the issue of the kind of the regulatory or enforcement regime in the private rental sector. And it is one in which the tenant plays a lead role, right? Because it's up to the tenant to identify breaches of the legislation or breaches of their rights and to address that by challenging their landlord or by registering a dispute with the Residential Tenancies Board. So the tenant is kind of in the driving seat in terms of how we regulate the private rental sector, but the tenant's ability to do that is undermined by insecurity. And so we continue to have this, what I would consider a culture of non-compliance in the sector, weak enforcement, and the policies that get introduced on paper don't end up having the effect in practice that we'd like them to have. So what we wanted to do was to generate evidence really for the first time about how tenants experience insecurity and how that shapes their ability to advocate for themselves and to address breaches of their rights.
And it's a really fundamental point because, like, what has happened over the last kind of 10 years has been this huge shift, and you've talked about it before, in terms of the numbers of people who are now living in the private rental sector. And I think a lot of people, particularly who are homeowners or middle to older age, have very little concept of kind of this structural shift that has taken place, our understanding, and it seeps into our politics as well, of this generation from in their 40s and under who are living, you know, in the private rental sector. Like, we've a doubling of the number of people. You probably have the exact number. I think it's 750,000 households. Is that correct now in the private rental sector?
Yeah, as that would be people. So it's about 320,000 households.
Yeah, 320,000 households. Like, it's a huge number who are living in this situation. It's not just a small number, and many of them have children, their families. And I think that, so it's really important that we try and understand this. Like, you're essentially living, as you describe, the sense of insecurity. And why are tenants the ones who have to be the, as you described, the kind of the enforcers, or why is that the situation? Like, they're,
I think the way we understand, well, the first thing I'd say is, you know, when we talk about the private rental sector, often the focus is on the issues of prices, affordability, and supply. That a lot of the conversation is around that. But when, you know, what tenants know is really something, there's something fundamental that we're missing here, which is the experience of being a renter, right? And what it means to try to make a home in the rental sector in the context of insecurity. A big part of that is, and this is something that comes across really strongly in our research, the relationship between the tenant and the landlord is crucial to understanding what's happening in the private rental sector, right? And the way we think in terms of legislation about that relationship, for example, if we look at the Residential Tenancies Act, is that it's a contractual relationship between two equal parties, each of which has rights and obligations under the Act, right? It's a very legalistic understanding of the relationship. And it's one which is, you know, that we have these two equal parties in the rental sector, and it's about maybe getting a balance between them. In reality, when we research the relationship between landlords and tenants, we see that it's actually a fundamentally asymmetrical power relationship between landlords and tenants, right? At the end of the day, a landlord controls a tenant's continuing access to their home. That is an enormous amount of power for one private household to exercise over another private household, right? And that means that the idea of tenants and landlords as equal parties is a fantasy, right? So,
isn't that the case that it's in Ireland that this is unique, and not completely unique? Obviously, the UK would be more similar, but it's not inherent that that has to be the relationship. That the problem is
that now, I mean, we can look at, I think, three different sets of factors which create this relationship, right? The first is the policy in the legislative context, which in Ireland gives landlords considerable scope to terminate tenancies, right? The second is the market context. When you have a very tight market, that means tenants are, as one tenant said in our report, they're easily replaceable. And of course, it's very difficult for tenants to find alternative accommodation, especially at an affordable price, right? So that intensifies tenants' dependency on their current landlord, which obviously intensifies that power relationship. And then finally, you have kind of cultural factors like norms around property rights, around the meaning of home, around the social status of tenants. So it's these three different domains, the legislative, the market, and the cultural, that shape the relationship between landlord and tenant. And in the Irish context, you're absolutely right. Those three factors work together to disempower tenants, essentially.
Tony, do you want to come in?
Yeah, no, Mick, I just the idea, the concept of home, because this is something now that we've seen successive governments fail at recognizing the right to a home. And then particularly when it terms, but they're pushing back now and saying, they will say now that it, surely an institutional landlord is now better than a mom and pop landlord, if this is the case, because they're professional class and they're more able to, there's more security with these international funds. Is there any valid reason we should accept that argument?
I mean, I think it's really interesting that you raised the concept of home, and that might be something we have obviously a much wider conversation about if we see a referendum on the right to housing during the term of this incoming government. And I think it might be something we come back to in this conversation as well. Mm. Our research is focused on the small scale landlords, right, which are the vast majority of landlords in the Irish context currently. But you're absolutely right that we've seen an enormous wave of investment in the private rental sector, or sometimes described as the build-to-rent sector, especially since 2016. I think it went from investment for that sector went from 6% of all transactions in Dublin in 2016 to almost half last year, right? So it has become the most intense sector investment in real estate in Ireland. over the last year or two in particular. So
8 in every 10 apartments built, I believe it was something phenomenal like that, were built to rent. Sorry, go ahead, Mick. I shouldn't have cut in, but it's a huge number of them now.
It's a huge number, and it's fascinating now, because when the rent pressure zones were introduced in 2016, we were told that, you know, capping prices is going to lead to a collapse of investments. Well, I mean, that has not materialized. We have seen an explosion of investment in the sector. So it's interesting in its own regard. But I definitely do think that the institutional landlords, they're not all the same, but I think they see themselves as providing what they describe themselves as best-in-class product. And they see that, and by that they mean a type of housing which is best-in-class, right? And what they tend to see that as meaning is having a lot of quite a high spec, a lot of additional amenities like the concierge, the gym, blah, blah, blah. And also, in some cases, they do emphasize aspects that we think about in terms of home, like tenants' control over the property, like being able to have pets, being able to decorate it. So I do think that they get it to a much greater extent than the small-scale landlords, and the professional level of property management is able to deliver a higher standard of housing for tenants. But unfortunately, it comes at a price which, you know, and they're quite open about this. I was at the Sunday Business Post National Property Summit last December, where there was a lot of presentations from Greystar and other companies in this space. And they were signaling very, very clearly that they are targeting high-earning, mainly migrant workers in the tech sector and the finance sector. They were very clear about that. That's what they're going for, young people on big wages with a lot of disposable income. So that's the drawback there.
And every other report that we've seen on that from Dublin City Council, from Fingal, from Dunleary has shown that where you have a high penetration, like saturation, if they account for, say, 20% of beds, 40% of all beds available, they drive the rents up for everybody else because they become the benchmark. So, it's, you know, it's not a case of, well, that building over there and that building over there are REITs. It's actually they then set their stall at $17.50 a month and everybody else's rent is dragged up as opposed to the other way around. So it is having a knock-on impact.
And the other area they have the impact, Tony, is that Orla Hegarty talks a lot about, is that the ability, what they can extract, the value from the land they develop, the ability to build these high-end units then pushes up land prices, which of course, and also they push out other potential affordable home providers or actual first-time purchasers, the cuckoo funds as well. Mick, in terms of the home idea, I think that is really important, because it's the kind of the solution, or not even the assumptions are, and even like around my book, I was talking to Pat Kenny on News Talk and Brendan O'Connor and RT about it, and they were straight in with the idea that, sure, everybody wants to own their own home. And this idea that renting is only this transitory thing. It's like for, you know, people who are, you know, whatever, students or young people, or it's like this transitory phase to becoming a homeowner. Whereas that thinking has to completely change, doesn't it? That for many people now in the rental sector, you know, buying a home is not possible, or is it feasible or desirable? But yet the service, you know, most people want to buy a home. What's your kind of view on that whole debate around assuming every renter wants to become a home ownership and that's what policy should be focused on?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. I think it's going to be interesting to see how our incoming government looks at this, because there's quite a strong reference in the programme for government to focusing on affordable home ownership and expanding Help to Buy, which we didn't see. I feel that wasn't so. I feel like the last government was much more strongly focused on promoting the build to rent sector, essentially. So we might see the home ownership supports that we are probably familiar with from the past here in Ireland becoming a more significant aspect of housing policy. In terms of home, I mean, look, my view is home is fundamental to human nature, right? I think there's a lot of social scientific evidence that shows that. I don't think any human being can survive long term without a home, and it is inherent to the very core of who we are as a species, if you like, right? And I think what home involves is much more than shelter, right? It involves shelter, but it also involves security, safety, peace, control, right? Privacy and control, right? Control over who comes into the space. It involves a routine. So there's a whole host of things that we, if you want to put it in economistic terms, that we consume when we consume a home. And I also, I do agree that currently home ownership provides those things much better than either of the two other tenures, social housing or private renting. And private renting is by far the worst at providing those things. So it is very rational that people would choose to become a homeowner over becoming a renter, especially when you think that it's cheaper, right? It's much better and it's much cheaper. So it's entirely rational. Now, I don't think we need to move to like a continental European model when everyone, where a majority are renting or where a high proportion are renting. I think we have to face, it's a choice that every society faces. What do you want? And what type of home do you want? The difficulty is, if you decide, well, we want to create a society where the vast majority are homeowners, you're going to have to subsidize a very large proportion of your population, you know, possibly as much as 30%, to help them access home ownership, because in urbanizing societies where there's a lot of pressure on urban land, they just won't be able to afford it, right? And subsidizing home ownership is much more expensive and much less efficient than subsidizing rental accommodation. So I think where you have cities where there's a high demand for housing and for land, you're going to have quite a hot market. And the most efficient way to subsidize access in that context is rental, I believe. And I think the cost rental model is the key there. However, in other types of contexts where there's not demand for land, I think home ownership can be something that's quite efficient and effective for the public sector to subsidize, especially in rural contexts or small towns where in Ireland today, the demand can be very, very low. And we see that in Austria, for example. A lot of people talk about Austria and how much it supports its wonderful cost rental sector. That's absolutely true. But they also support home ownership in rural areas and small towns where land prices are cheap, and therefore it's not a big constraint on government finances to support people. So I think you have to make a decision as a society. What do you want? What type of home do you want? And then you look at your resources and think, how can we get there?
Yeah. But isn't it also a case you have to look at, you know, where your country is at, where your population is at? Because I think in many ways, what strikes me about the promotion of home ownership is that there's many people, like we've just had a decade of austerity, people's wages been stagnant, we have precarious work, we have this going to be massive challenges of people to access mortgages. And even if you give them access to mortgages, they're competing in a housing system in Ireland now in the big cities, which you mentioned, you're right to say, that where global investors have come in and are dominating the markets. And so in this current context, giving people access to mortgages without doing a whole load of other things, like, for example, taxing the real estate funds, taxing the big investors, or give first-time buyers a priority in buying properties, unless you make all those other changes, their money, giving them mortgages, isn't going to access housing, enable them to access housing.
I spoke to Dara O'Brien last week, the day before he was called, he's been appointed as the Minister for Housing, and he spoke about affordable housing, he spoke about the range, he spoke about affordable rental, and he spoke about the range. All of the ranges that he spoke about were actually would fall within what I would deem to be affordable. Unfortunately, the fear I have, and looking at the way the delivery method looks like, it's going to be via the private and heavily subsidized models. So if we're heavily subsidizing models, it still means that, you know, the unit price may bloody well be 360,000, and you could probably purchase it at 230, but there's still cost to the state is still the 360. They are looking at ways of taking the land, extracting the land value and keeping the land effectively to the state. And that is one model that they are pursuing. But I don't know if that's scalable with that volume of things. But back, more importantly, back to tenants. And I think it's Lorcan Sir made the point a couple of years ago that we've more or less shifted three generations in terms of home ownership to more people renting in a decade compared to, you know, what other countries evolved into. They evolved over 30, 40 years. We did it in nearly 10 to 15. So there's also a knowledge gap where someone like me who has owns his own home is sitting there thinking, oh, sure, yeah, my kids will just go through the process like I did. Tenants sitting now, is there, what can tenants be doing to be getting a fairer shake of the stick? And is there, what avenues are open to? I know you mentioned the resident, the PRTB and that, but what is the real way of getting that? Because they are a big cohort of people now that they weren't 10 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's been an enormous change. And I think as well, sometimes this alludes a little bit to our previous conversation. Sometimes we think about ourselves as a country that promotes home ownership. And I don't think that's true anymore. I think that was true 20 or 30 years ago. I think we're a country that promotes private renting. That's the reality of government policy and the reality of our labour market as well. It supports private renting. It doesn't support home ownership. That's the norm now, as I see it, in terms of policy. But we don't have the legislation and the culture to make that work for people. So I think there's a huge change needed in terms of legislation. And a lot of that, what we need to get to is a situation where you rent your house and then during the tenancy period, whatever length that is, in Ireland currently under Irish law, that's 6 years. So let's say 6 years. During that tenancy period, the tenancy cannot be terminated as a result of something which is outside the control of the tenant. Right? The tenant needs to know, if I pay my rent, don't engage in antisocial behaviour, and I don't damage the property beyond normal wear and tear, I'm going to be able to stay here. There's nothing outside of my control. So we need to bring the tenant's home into the tenant's control. That's the key problem that we have in the sector. It's not. It's in the landlord's control. That gives landlords power. It ruins tenants' experience of home, and it leads to high levels of non-compliance on the part of landlords, right? A whole bunch of problems that we can solve just by protecting tenants. And that's something, by the way, that we can do at the stroke of a pen at no cost to the exchequer, right? The other side of this is there is a politics to this, right? There's a conflict of interest between the majority of Irish households who are owners of real estate and a growing minority of tenants who are not owners of real estate. That's a political conflict. And in every political conflict, you know, what's going to come into play is how organized each party is and how effective they are at pursuing their interests. Tenants are not well represented, and there is no independent, or there has been no independent tenant organized or organization here. But we have seen that change in recent years. There's been a number of housing groups that have tried to organize tenants, and we now have the Community Action Tenants Union, which is kind of bringing a lot of that work together, and I think can play a very, very important role in advocating on behalf of tenants, but also bringing tenants together so that they can organize collectively and be more effective in advocating for their interests. And that is a trend that we've seen internationally as well. We've had a bunch of tenants unions have been set up in Spain, in the UK, in the US. And so I think there's going to be an international trend in which political struggle, if you like, or contestation on the part of tenants is going to become a much more important part of our political systems.
Yeah, and I completely agree. And I think I was quite struck there because I was going to ask you directly and make the similar point that you just made, that with a stroke of a pen, politicians, the government in place now, could put in place a situation whereby everybody in the private rental sector actually had the security of a home. Which is quite shocking when you think about it, that they leave all these people in a situation of insecurity. And what would you think the key legislation like that should change tomorrow to make this a reality?
I think there's two things you can do. So the first is the Residential Tenancies Act sets out a number of grounds under which a landlord can terminate a tenancy within the tenancy period, right? The main ones are intention to sell, intention to use personally or by their family member, and intention to refurbish, as well, of course, as rent arrears or antisocial behaviour, right? But in terms of the stuff that's beyond the tenant's control, now the first problem with these is that they are all based on landlords' intentions. Now, needless to say, only landlords can verify their own intentions. So yes, this really empowers landlords, and I argue that it fosters and facilitates our culture of non-compliance, right? So I think we need to remove the word intention from the Residential Tenancies Act, and that level of uncertainty is, in my view, really, really unacceptable. The second thing is, I think we need, you know, what I would argue is we should remove those grounds altogether. It should be a case that the landlord enters into a tenancy and they sign up to rent the property for that period. At the end of that period, they can then, you know, decide to sell, or maybe they want it for family use or whatever. But I think there has to be a commitment for a period, right?
Yeah.
And both parties know, and that's what you get when you rent a car. You know, when you rent a car, if you rent a car for a month, they can't turn around 3 days later and say, no, I actually want to use that car, my cousin needs it. Right, that happens in the rental sector, right? But it's in other sectors, it's assumed that when you rent something for a period, you have access to that thing for that period. So that's I think all tenants are looking for. It's not, you know, this is not radical change, and I think it's really impossible to argue that the rental sector can provide a home for people without those types of changes.
And I think, is there an issue around, because we've seen this, and this brings us on to, the conversation around the right to housing, that if the Attorney General, which we've seen, has blocked, or the government has previously blocked bills that have proposed removing the ground to sale and the moving the family member in on the basis of interfering with the right to private property of the landlord, what's your view on that? Do you think that they could get this legislation without constitutional change, or think we need constitutional change, or do you have a view on it?
I can't imagine that you need constitutional change. I mean, most things are rented out on the basis of a commitment on the part of the person who's renting it for a defined period of time. I don't see why it should be any different with housing. I think, but on the other hand, I should say that I'm, you know, far from being an expert on constitutional law, so I don't have any expertise there. But I think if it was indefinite, there may be, that's where issues would arise, you know. But the landlord is choosing to enter into a contract with the tenant, so I feel that their right to enjoy private property and the fruits of their property is very hard to see how it's been.
Even contract law would say, and you know, you'd know that is within mortgages, that there is an onus on the person who signs the contract and the person who issues the contract. So absolutely, there's, you know, so you're right to point out, Mick, that okay, this is we're talking about testing it against towards the Constitution. Yeah, but any contract solicitor would tell you that, you know, there's an onus on both sides that enter into an agreement, not just on the person who signs it. So no, you've a service. I've provided the service. It's not as simple as that. Very last thing for me though, is in terms of the actual rental market itself now, if you see tenants entering it now, and I saw Stephen Kinsella pose the question yesterday about if you were forced to cut £1 billion from the budget in 1 year, it was a hypothetical thing, and he said, what would you do? And I didn't reply, and I just thought, I said, I wonder what would happen if I removed the rent subsidies, the HAPs and the rent, the RAS, and would, you know, overnight would the market just tremble, and would rents ultimately fall? In your studies and in your investigations into these things, are they forcing other people into more difficult choices in terms of rent, you know, putting up with substandard things because they need the landlord takes HAP or the landlord takes RAS and they can't go anywhere else?
Yes. I mean, that's certainly there in the research, right? That HAP tenants and rent supplement recipients, which I know Rory has researched as well, they experience discrimination very clearly, and they report, you know, there are landlords that actually actively seek HAP tenants, but there are many landlords, the majority, from what tenants say, and research from Threshold and the St. Vincent de Paul also corroborates this, is that they, you know, they feel invisible in the rental market, landlords don't want to know, etc. And that really intensifies, and sorry, I should just say as well that the experience of looking for a property when you're being discriminated against like that is quite demeaning for our tenants, right? Tenants, and they're very clear about this, it's extremely frustrating and demeaning to be begging another human being for a home and for them not to give that to you, to decide not to give that to you because, you know, they don't think you're good enough type of thing, right? Or because you're stigmatized, right? That's very demeaning, especially, you know, I interview people, you know, who are fathers, you know, and maybe, I don't know how to describe it, but maybe they had traditional ideas of masculinity or whatever, and they felt the responsibility, of course, to their family and to their children. And to be a man with three children and you're begging to be housed by a landlord, it is demeaning. It's very demeaning. So HAP tenants really want to avoid being back in the situation where they're looking, where they're in the rental market, right? They want to avoid that experience and that discrimination. That makes them very dependent on their current landlord. And you know, they're very clear about this. We heard it in the interviews time and time again. I don't want to rock the boat. I don't want to store up something. I'm afraid of losing the tenancy, et cetera, et cetera. So it's tenants face some really, really difficult decisions, as you put it, Tony.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a really good summation, and I think it's really important for us to think about. And you know, the report, I really recommend people to have a read of it, and you know, to look at it. And it's really important we talk about tenant situations, and as you mentioned there, the tenants union as well, encourage people who are tenants to get involved, and you know, because with that action and taking action, they can make change. I was quite struck by those two things, the notion of home and people having control over their home, but also that government could change this situation overnight. And again, I do think that the right to housing and have a referendum on that would guarantee that and give a government both the impetus and the support and the foundation to be able to put in place those changes. But Mick, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Best of luck with the, I know you're doing a launch later on, launch of the report.
Thanks, guys. It's been brilliant chatting.
Thanks, Mick. It is, by the way, that tenants union you mentioned is CATU. They're on Twitter at CATU Ireland, by the way, just to let listeners know, if they want to check it out, catuireland.org. And if you can, please help us keep going. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye-bye.